co-sponsor the Paul Murphy bill, resolution of disapproval against the arms deal. Also, ask your representatives in the House to co-sponsor the companion Amash Pocan bill.
Okay.
The more people we get, the more momentum we get.
Thank you very much for joining me today, Robert Nayman of justforeignpolicy.org. And I want to thank all of you out in the listening audience for being your intelligent and thoughtful selves. We are now going to complete today. Our engineer was also our AM News and Public Affairs Director, Derek Crooks, and I want to thank him. And now we're going to go on to the rest of a great KBOO morning.
What would you have instead?
No, this is it.
There comes a time when every second, every day, when every action, every thought will tell the world cast your vote. They break our legs and we take back you with the oppressed creature.
Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Engineering Committee will meet on the first Wednesday at 7 p.m.
Exploring Asian American and African American relations.
Throughout most of history, Asian Americans and African Americans have not stood up with each other. We need to recognize that those instances when Asians and African Americans and other people of color have risen up together are exceptional moments in U.S. history.
Crossing East Relations, a new one-hour documentary by Dimay Roberts, Tuesday, June 6th at 11 a.m. on KBOO, Portland.
And this is KBOO, Portland. It's 9:02 a.m. coming up on Pacific Underground. I'll be speaking with Changelab's Scott Nakagawa in a wide-ranging discussion about the current state of race in America. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, featuring headlines, interviews, and commentary with your host, Chris Andre. And at 10:15, a special edition of Locus Focus, observing the one-year anniversary of the Mosier train derailment and oil fire. At 11, a Radio Geekly dives into the progressive movement within geek culture. And thanks to KBOO members for your generous support. And if you're not currently a member, you can remedy that oversight at kboo.fm and click on the word donate. And now, as promised, a Radio Geekly.
Welcome to Pacific Underground, the show where Asians and Pacific Islanders take the mic into our own hands. I'm Tabitha Tew.
And I'm Jenny Yokoyama. We're your hosts this month. As for sure many of our listeners are aware, this month was the election, and the results were less than ideal, to be diplomatic.
In the wake of the traumatizing election results, we felt the need to reach out to someone to ask the same questions we were asking each other. What's with the reactions we're seeing from all these different groups? What do we need to focus on? And what is it that we need to avoid to make sure we don't further divide ourselves?
This month, fellow producer Candace Schlesinger and I sat down with veteran anti-fascist activist and writer Scott Nakagawa of the grassroots political lab Change Lab and blog Race Files to get his perspective of living in Trump's America. In addition to hearing from Scott, you'll also hear some commentary from me and Kanan as we attempt to grapple with the complexity of talking about race and oppression in a time of heightened racial awareness.
So this past week, following the election, we decided we needed some insight and to listen to someone who had more experience than us in being smart and grounded in matters of race and gender and all sorts of different avenues through which people are oppressed. So we decided to hit up our friend Scott Nakagawa, a longtime activist, originally from Hawaii, I believe, lived in Portland in the 80s and 90s when there was a lot of white supremacy, open skinheadedry, and he recently moved back after being in the South for a while. And at a very important moment, Scott wrote an article, it's called The Next Wave, and I thought it was very insightful. What did you think, Jenna?
You know, it's a really thought-provoking piece, and I'm really glad that he brought it out because he published it right after, maybe what, like a week after the elections. And so it's kind of his rambling thoughts of where do we go from here. And so he talks about a lot of things in The Next Wave. Is it called The Next Wave?
I think it's The Next Wave, yeah.
The Next Wave. I was really glad that we got an opportunity to speak with him shortly after he wrote it to kind of get a little more in depth to understand where he was coming from when he wrote that.
You could tell he has a book in the works or something because it's like each, like every third paragraph deserves to be its own chapter.
I know. If he's not writing a book, he needs to expand it into a book.
Right.
Right.
Totally. It seems like So in this article, The Next Wave, Getting Ready for Trump's America, there is a lot of conceptualization of these ideas, a lot of like abstract ideas.
Yeah, something I've always like really enjoyed about Scott Nakagawa is that he is an activist in the, you know, anti-fascist world. So he does do work that's, you know, on the extreme end of the spectrum.
We interviewed Scott Nakagawa many moons ago, and now we've turned to him again. Let's get more into that.
These are people who are now very vulnerable, and we need to be prepared to provide them with sanctuary because their vulnerability is our vulnerability. If we do not hold ourselves together in this time and hold each of us in our embrace, eventually they're going to come for us, right? That's, I think, the mentality we have to have. I don't want to make people panic, but, you know, I think that that's the kind of resolve we have to feel, you know. And that, you know, if they come for you in the morning, they will, you know, come for me at night. That sentiment of Angela Davis's. I think that that's something really, really important to do. Actually, many people who are listening probably know of someone named Howard Wynand. He's a very beloved scholar, activist, a racial, person who's a race scholar who has made a really profound impact. He offers a few tips for us. First of all, what he says is, you know, we should be very concerned about internet censorship because that is one avenue that we still have for communicating and for, you know, freely expressing ourselves. And we need to think both about secure communication, but we also need to think about protecting the internet, right? Commercial media is beyond our reach. You know, I mean, cable exists for a reason, right? And so, you know, one of the places that we can actually do that kind of communication and documentation is on the internet, and we need to preserve it. We also need to be concerned about roundups of undocumented radicals. Those people are likely to be immediately targeted. We have to be concerned about surveillance. You know, it's a huge surveillance state. It's the most bloated and powerful surveillance state we've ever had. New technologies make it cheaper and better and easier to continue all of that stuff and also put some of that stuff in the hands of ordinary people. And so we need to be aware that that's what Trump is, you know, what he's got going for him right now. And recognize that we need to be aware of it and we need to be reacting to it as a real problem. And then we need to, you know, really seriously think about where we are situated relative to the Movement for Black Lives and anti-partisan movements. He suggests that one of the reasons to try to position ourselves there is because they have a big base in black and brown communities who are going to be very, very vulnerable. And but they also do have allies among elites, right? Those movements are actually situated in a way that there are a lot of different kinds of people who are concerned about them because that issue of police brutality and the, you know, killing of people on the streets is something that, of course, is broadly appealing as a call to action, right? other thing is he believes that everyone should be in an organization that has their back, right? So people who don't now belong to organizations should seek them out, and not just political organizations, but religious, cultural, social, you know, civic organizations where you really genuinely are inside the group, you know, where people have your back. You can exercise influence there. You can mobilize people to take action, but you can also seek refuge, right? And form personal affinity groups with the people who truly believe what you truly believe, right? They can be small groups, but those groups are groups that can mobilize quickly and do what's necessary at times when it, you know, you really need to move. If a major demonstration, for example, is organized, you can quickly get the people in your affinity group together and go. And, you know, recognize that, of course, there are a couple of big ideas here. One is that race and gender trump class right now, and that's what Trump showed us, right? These are the avenues down which authoritarian and anti-democratic forces drive.
I really identify with what Scott had to say about Harvey Weinman's suggestion of the first few steps that people take, that it's about community. So I feel like when we were coming out of the elections, people were feeling really kind of like disjointed, and I think feeling very much like alone in their anger and fear. And you saw a lot of people wanting to turn to somewhere in order to maybe find community or answers or who knows what everybody was looking for. But yeah, joining a community, definitely.
Totally. And these communities that have existed long before this moment that do have themselves grounded and organized and networked and ready to mobilize, like Scott said. And, it, you know, it's not about, like, throwing money into a different furnace that's going to, like, feed the fire of the opposite movement, you know?
Yeah.
All these different groups have a vested interest in having solidarity and looking out for one another, even though we don't need to agree on everything.
And then also, and as groups and communities are moving forward, I hope that they're really listening to, you know, the types of things that people like Scott are saying. Scott is a veteran in this movement, in the activist movement, you know, where the advice is, one, don't reinvent the wheel. There's already people who have these systems already set up to help fight fascism. But also who you're protecting, you know, who is at the top of the list of protecting. It's not necessarily just about protecting your own community. It's about figuring out who is the most at risk. And he's right, like radicals who are immigrants or undocumented immigrants are definitely the most at risk. And so it's about people needing to recognize where they sit, I think, in their communities and where their communities even sit within the larger picture. So I appreciate him, you know, giving us those first few steps, which are actually really pretty simple, and they feel less overwhelming when I hear him say it. It's like, hey, join a group of people who are already together. It's like, oh, that's simple.
Yeah, right.
The way that we go about protesting is something that's going to send a message to the whole world. What we have experienced here is very similar, I think, to what happened in Great Britain in the Brexit vote, where, you know, Great Britain voted, the British voters voted to leave the European Union. That was a terrible move on their part. You know, they basically marginalized themselves economically, and they're, you know, now going to start to face, I think, some pretty serious consequences. It was a reaction to austerity at some level. Well, greater austerity is going to follow that election. It was a reaction to immigration. Well, you know, they're not protecting themselves from immigration by doing this. They've cut off avenues of escape, actually. So for us here, we need to recognize a similar thing has happened, you know, and that it's going to happen around the world. So the whole world is watching, right? Day after the election, the biggest Korean daily newspaper, you know, angry white people overturn America is the headline, right? You know, so we need to hold a mirror up to the world in which they can see themselves as bold and powerful and empowered and dignified, right? In that Brexit vote I referenced, right now in Great Britain, the margin of victory of the Leave side is smaller than the number of people who voted for Leave who regret doing it. They were protest voters, a lot of them. I think we're going to see that in this election, too. Over 60% of people who voted for Trump didn't expect him to win. they were protest voters in that group. Not all of them, but I just know there has to be some protest voters in that group. We need to give those people time to pivot. When that buyer's remorse starts to come up, we need to allow that to be assert itself as a news story. It's very hard to govern upstream against that, right? And we give people that room to pivot, not by making them the goats of this election, but making that pivot be heroic, right? And so we need to hold them in our embrace and not immediately alienate them. When we do protests and we engage in direct action, the other thing we should keep in mind is that you're drawing the fire of the other side, right? So blue rage is a real thing. Be aware of it. You know, take responsibility for what you do and recognize that there are those among you who are vulnerable who may be damaged if you go too far. The other piece of it is that the serious right, the paramilitary right, is looking for any opportunity to escalate. Those guys outgun us like crazy. And a lot of them are retired military and police officers. They know how to use the weapons that they have. And so you're asking for a fight you can't win, right? The other thing is that when conflict like that arises, it's the perfect excuse for the state to roll out state repression, right? So that fifth column we saw in this election, you know, the FBI going after Clinton, you know, that's a real problem that we face now. We should remember COINTELPRO. People should look it up. They should, like, use your Google machine, COINTELPRO, and, you know, understand what our government has done before through, you know, the repressive agencies that we have. That was a murderous regime. We cannot have that. We cannot have that again. We cannot give the Trump administration the excuse to go in that direction. Do not allow yourself to be the perfect foil against which the other side can escalate. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't be, bold and brave in what you do. Just know that for every season, there is a tactic, right? And perhaps this is not that season. Not yet, maybe. And so have some discipline. Hold it in. I know it feels good to go there. I know it feels good to call them racist buttheads. I know it feels good. It's cathartic. If you go to my Facebook page, it's like post after post of catharsis from Election Day on, right? We need to pivot off of that and start to try to reach for the broadest coalition possible, a majoritarian movement, right? And try to move forward in that way.
Counterintelligence program right now. Why don't you just go look it up? Because the agencies that we're trying to downplay the role of in our lives that we're not taking like active steps to guard against when we send text messages that are not encrypted, you know, NSA, FBI, CIA, those people like carried out assassinations. They carried out like widespread surveillance programs against the Black Panther Party and other so-called extremist groups. I mean, damn, like that's not unprecedented. Like that is part of the United States history. Like there are arms of our government that operate autonomously that aren't under the control of the Trump administration, but within which the Trump administration is going to have very insidious influence.
And what terrifies me about all that is just, you know, when I think back to, say, the civil rights movement, and I look at the level of technology that they had, right? You know, yes, you had people being monitored by the government, but they didn't have Twitter yet, and they didn't have Facebook, and they didn't have smartphones. You know, we have so many means to be just tracked by the government these days. It's slightly terrifying.
Totally. And like so much more intimate information too. Like we write about virtually every part of our lives through these mediums.
I mean, we all have a live microphone around us all the time when you think about it, right? I've been looking at everybody's cell phones and how many people have Siri activated and Google Voice, you know, all these things where your phone is just keeping its microphone all the time on, waiting for you to speak to it. It's like, well, who the heck else is listening to me? My God.
Right.
A point that Scott had made when he was talking about protest is that, as you're saying, the quality of protest, and we have to think about the consequences of our protest. First of all, we just need to talk about this, and maybe this has nothing to do with the Scott Nakagawa interview, or maybe it totally does, but Kanan and I, in addition to producing for Pacific Underground, are also actively involved with the KBOO News, And so we both covered some of the protest for the KBOO News. One thing that I will say really I found kind of upsetting or disturbing and watching the protests is the word privilege kept coming up in my mind. I know that keeps coming out of people's mouth a lot these days. But one person I ran into at the protest was this man who was not part of the protest, but was just observing it. And he was telling me how terrible he thought it was that all these Black Lives Matter people were destroying property in the city. And I explained to him that it was actually people who were self-declared anarchists who were doing it, and that actually the vast majority of them, like 99% of them, were white males that were actually doing it, but that the media was spinning it as though it was Black Lives Matter. You know, I think you can be an anarchist while being peaceful, but yet these people who decided to use violence as their protest, I think were maybe short-sighted in maybe their understanding of racial politics and how violence is portrayed in our society. It is always blamed on the people who are being oppressed the most.
I saw a lot of people whose reactions were like, those aren't even anarchists. Like, those are like smashy bros who are out here to break things. And, you know, like you say, are actually like really perpetuating a lot of racism in the people that are consuming the media that's capturing what's happening. Any sort of like cause and effect thing can be manipulated by the media to further a story. There is very little that the people who are dressed in all black breaking things have to do with the actual intentions of the people that organized the protest and the people that were really embodying the spirit of the protest. The only thing that I really saw that communicated the intention of the protest, that like spoke to what like the spirit of the protest was the chant "peaceful protest." But that quickly became a parody of itself because people would chant that in response to people agitating for more violence. You know, it just became a joke because it's like peaceful protest, but like, yeah. You know, like that doesn't mean anything when there are canisters of tear gas flying at you anymore. Like, there is no peaceful protest when the police decides to escalate things into the category of a riot by showing up in riot gear. And I think that's a conversation to be at too. Like, the response of the police is everything in de-escalating or escalating a situation in the streets. In sort of like the post-election confusion in the microcosm of Portland, something I've noticed is that there's the divisions that we're talking about of gender and class and the various degrees of awakening and awareness that people in our community have to those dynamics in our lives are playing out in like activist circles. They're playing out in like marginalized groups that are trying to organize. And I think there you touch on in the article this this disagreement, and I think it actually manifested in the comment section, because the first person I noticed that commented was essentially asserting that, no, you're wrong. Like, we can't afford to be babying people and like trying not to hurt their feelings by using words. You know, I think labels right now more than ever are like polarizing and kind of like factionizing different groups in our country, like Trump supporter, like that is a term to me that is like essentially meaningless. As you're talking about protest votes, like that, that doesn't really mean anything beyond the scope of this election. But although it does speak to a lot about this moment, racist, ignorance. So like these words, instead of bringing people together and creating this coalition, it seems like it creates isolation and sort of alienation. And so how do we go about, like, what sort of concrete ways do you think we can go about, like, bring people in instead of perpetuating this call-out culture that seems to take root when there is a lot of fear and a lot of anger, and those emotions are the first things to come up when we hear latent and subtle ways that certain people, white people specifically, you know, carry out violence against other people?
Well, you know, first of all, those who want to read the article, when I said what I did in that article that provoked a response. Basically, what I said was that, you know, we have to stop leading in organizing white people, leading with privilege as a problem, right? And the reason I said that is because so much of white anti-racist organizing is all about privilege, right? Attacking people's privilege. Well, you know, you can't really organize people successfully if you don't know how to meet them where they're at. You can't begin by saying, you know what, all this undeserved stuff you have that you aren't even aware of and have been like messing over other people with, let's start there. It's really demobilizing. And so I'm not saying that we shouldn't, that privilege isn't a really important critique. It is, in fact, I think a very important critique because it is hugely what is up in white cultural hegemony, which is a really big problem that we face, right? But you can't lead with it, right? First of all, it doesn't allow you to then identify issues. Like, what are the solutions? Is it an each one, teach one thing? Because if that's the way we're going, we don't have that much time, right? It also provokes guilt, which is the last thing I want in my comrades, is that the reason why you're working with me is because you feel guilty. You know, I want you to believe that this is in your self-interest to do something, because then I know that that relationship is durable. That solidarity makes sense to me because you're in it for you and not just for me, right? I also think that it is just super important to recognize that all of us are in some kind of journey, right? None of us is perfect. That kind of self-righteousness sort of begins there, you know? And I understand where that stuff comes from. You know, I mean, I'm a 54-year-old man. I haven't always been this age. I haven't always had 37 years of movement activism behind me. You know, there was a time when I was just about the most self-righteous person in the room, and I would call you out in a second. And, you know, I'm pretty good at words. I could cut you with my tongue. And so, you know, I get where that stuff comes from. It's cathartic. You know, it feels good. I get it. You know, we just can't have a politics of catharsis, right? You know, it's something that you learn as you go along and realize, I just keep losing, you know? Why is that the case? And so a couple of things to keep in mind, I think. One is that authoritarianism, which has been talked about a lot in this election, that's something that manifests itself across the political spectrum from left to right, right? I mean, you know, welcome to Stalin's Russia. You know, I mean, authoritarianism is an impulse that is all the way across. It's not just a right-wing thing. And part of what people in this election reacted to who supported Trump is authoritarianism, right? The perception of authoritarianism, real authoritarianism, which is why they don't like big government, right? And the perception of authoritarianism, which is what weaponizes that political correctness trope, right? So we should keep that in mind. That's not to say that that anti-authoritarianism is the anti-authoritarianism of the left. There's a really big difference because the right-wing anti-authoritarianism has a color line that runs through it and a gender line that runs through it that we have to say is unacceptable. But we also need to avoid the temptation to move in that authoritarian direction. It is expressed in things like hate crime laws, for example, and in the call-out culture that you referenced, and a lot of other things, right? We have to keep in mind that when you want a law, and I'm not saying people shouldn't ask for these laws, but when you want a law, for example, you know, guaranteeing your right to use a public restroom regardless of your gender expression, right? That's a great thing. We can't define the public in a way that excludes people based on their gender orientation, right? The thing is, we also should do so mindful of the fact that when that right is violated, who are you going to call? Ghostbusters? No, you call the police. So each of those laws becomes a vector of violence, right? And so that doesn't mean you don't do it. That doesn't mean you don't do it. We just have to figure out, where does this all fit together and where are we moving? How can we get to the point where we're no longer relying on those vectors of violence in order to ensure that people have the right to full participation in society? Because as long as we are relying on them, we don't have the right to full participation in society. That's something that Black Lives Matter is teaching us, right? So I think super important. The other thing, I know I'm talking on and on, but, you know.
No, continue.
It's the time. Adrenaline, adrenaline.
But, exactly.
It's, you know, that there's this kind of impulse toward anti-racist reductionism, right? So, you know, I reacted on Facebook to hearing people in the media, especially on MSNBC. Lately, I hate MSNBC, saying this thing about how, you know, it wasn't just race. It wasn't just race, in a way as if to minimize the role of race in people's decision-making, right?
This is one of the arguments that make me the most infuriated
to
read
on
the internet.
Right? I mean, it's so much like BS.
Yep.
But the thing is, you know, my response to that is it's never just about race. Slavery wasn't just about race. Native genocide wasn't just about race. It was also about greed. It was also about territory. It was also about expulsions. You know, white folks who didn't have a lot of money, who were free soilers, you know, couldn't compete with major slave-owning plantations, right? And so they were expelled and forced to move. And as they did, participated in Indian removal, right? And so, you know, these are the kinds of dynamics. They're much more complex than we think they are. But at the same time, they're not just about race. They're ultimately all about race, right? I mean, how do we understand Native genocide and slavery separate and apart from race? You never say, well, you know, slavery wasn't just about race in talking about an issue like that in the media. On the other hand, though, there's a flip side, right? And the flip side is how we often deal with race is merely about hate or prejudice or about the character of the individual who's saying that word or doing that thing, right? You know, it's never just about race. It's also about much, much more. And the stuff that is all that much, much more is not just harming people of color. It's harming working class white people too. People are choosing to act in a way that is against their own interests. It's up to us to teach them something different, right? To everybody who has told me this, and I hear this all the time, it's not my job to teach white people about racism. Well, it's not. And nobody's requiring you to do it. I would suggest it's a good idea, though, because opting out of it, well, hello, you know, what just happened, right? What just happened? It's everybody's job to teach everybody, regardless of race, about racism. We have to do it. And we have to do it in a way that is not just about race, right? We have to marry race and class. We need to just get out of this useless, damaging, I think, debate, which is more important, race or class. Stop thinking of those things separately. The prison industrial complex is Jim Crow criminal justice. The undocumented workers situation is Jim Crow immigration. We still live in a system of racial exploitation. Race and class are inseparable from one another. All class is raced and all race is class. That's just how it is. The model minority idea is a class idea. You know, all of these things are class idea. White working class people are raced, right? That's also a racial state that they're in. And, you know, when people talk about the white working class and they're like, well, white working class people are feeling the pinch, you know, that's what they're reacting to. It's like, yeah, you know how I know that? Because everybody's feeling the pinch.
Exactly.
You know, working class people across the board are feeling the pinch, not just the white ones. Let's stop talking about it that way. You know, let's stop talking about it that way. It weaponizes all of this rage.
So what you didn't hear when Scott was talking about leading with privilege is that I asked him about call-out culture, and I was asking him about what he one aspect, or I guess one point that he touched on in his article, which was, we can't be, he said it much more eloquently than this, but we can't be hurting people's feelings if we're trying to gather momentum, if we're trying to be inclusive and gather the broadest coalition possible to combat Trump's fascism. We need to be inclusive. We need to, you know, acknowledge that privilege exists, but that it alienates people when you call them out. And I think it was really, really eye-opening for me that he linked that to authoritarianism, because that's something that I've felt, but to articulate it in such a way is something that is still like really novel for me, even like because we associate authoritarianism with like a style of government, like
yeah.
Saddam Hussein, Gaddafi, you know, George W. Bush.
You know, getting back to an episode that we did a few months ago, we aired a piece that I had produced about, we called it The Culture of Fear. And to me, I always think about FDR when people talk about authoritarianism, because America freaking loves FDR, right? They're What was his big thing? Oh, the New Deal, right? That was his thing, and everyone just loves to lift him up for the New Deal. But I always want to tell people, like, you know, don't forget what Japanese Americans think of this man. Like, I just see authoritarianism right there, right? He declared an emergency state, like Scott was talking about, and then allowed him to have emergency control, you know? And that's always how we see authoritarianism take over democracies. Because, hey, you're still in a democracy, right? Hitler was in a democracy. Also in that last clip, one thing I love is Scott making fun of himself, talking about, you know, what it was like for him when he first started getting into activism and the growing pains that he went through. And that's, I think, what you were just kind of talking about is what I'm seeing with a lot of people right now. And I think a lot of people who have been fighting this fight for a long time are just kind of watching all this reaction happen from the population at large. And you just kind of want to calm everyone down and just be like, dude, okay, first, before we go and jump, let's just have like a little sit, maybe have a talk with people who know more than you and talk about why they're not jumping off the cliff.
But I'm mad.
Mm-hmm. It's a teachable moment, as certain people in education say. I like that. I agree with Scott that it is our obligation to educate. And it's a conversation that probably most of the people that are listening to right now, that are listening to us right now, have like either taken part in or have listened to. And there's no way around it, right? Like, we're not going to like send someone a YouTube video and then they're going to be educated. They need to be educated in situations that impact them, that they find themselves in organically in their lives.
Yeah, I say, you know, as you were talking about the call-out culture, and you're saying it's time to call people in, or at times we feel like we need to be calling people in. That's what I hear Scott saying, like, you know, we have to get over calling people out. Call people in, because that's really the only way that we can move this discussion beyond just like, well, you're racist. Like,
right.
All white people are racist. Like, it's just not helpful. It's just not helpful. It's we've had 2 weeks of rage. It's time to call in. It's time to call everybody in and just like help each other understand and close this gap of polarization we have.
If you're just tuning in and want to catch the first half of the show, you can head to kboo.fm to find an archived version of this show, or head to our webpage at pacificunderground.org. Let's get back to the interview.
So since our show is, you know, a show that is about APIs, and we hope our audience is, we're trying to focus our show towards APIs, as an Asian American activist yourself, let's keep going on this Asian road. I'm just kind of wondering if you have any kind of thoughts about it that are specific to our community about, I don't know if, I guess there's been a lot of questions I've been seeing going around, especially from APIs that I know, or specifically Asian Americans, not so much Pacific Islanders, but Asian Americans, over the last week, talking about their privilege and like, and the questions of, do I have privilege? This whole everything that's been going over the last week has made me wonder a lot about privilege. And even though I think for, you know, especially the last like 20 years or so, there's been this idea of trying to knock down that model minority myth, especially that word. I wish people would just stop saying it, you know, oh, it drives me nuts. But I think that over the last week, what we've seen from a lot of people who aren't necessarily in activist circles and have not really, I say, taking an active part in trying to fight oppression and stuff like that, this, I think that that's a lot of people who are shocked right now, who have just been kind of like living life, right? And they've not been focusing on these issues, and now suddenly these things are kind of pushed in their face, and they're having to realize that their own level of oppression in this country that they thought they maybe had, quote unquote, like overcome, right? And I feel like that's being questioned a lot in the Asian American community. I know it's a lot in the Japanese American community, because we're often pushed as the model minority. I'm just kind of wondering if you have any thoughts.
Well, Japanese Americans are the original model minority. You know, Japanese Americans invented the idea to a large extent, you know, not in the way we understand it now, but as a shield against what happened to Japanese Americans during the World War II period, right? And so, you know, in order to integrate back into society, people, you know, came up with this very favorable picture that would make people stop hating Japanese Americans. I mean, you know, when you've been interned, it seems like a pretty logical response. We have to recognize that that's not serving us, though, right? It's not serving us at all. There really is a thing called Asian privilege that mostly is about East Asians, right? About Japanese, Korean, Chinese Americans, which is not to say every member of those groups are privileged, but that perception of the model minority applies most to us, right? And so I think it's important to keep it in mind. Privilege, though, is not the same thing as power. Privilege is something that's conferred upon you by the powerful, and usually for a reason. So we should ask ourselves why, right? In this case, around the model minority thing, it is both a class thing for us, right? And it is an anti-black trope. Because you never talk about the model minority without comparing the model minority to other minority groups that haven't been as successful, right? And so basically we've been cast as the, you know, heroes in a Horatio Alger story about social mobility, right? Where, you know, hard work and quiet, stoical, you know, cooperation has rewarded people because the system really works, right? And so, you know, a couple of things to think about. First of all, Asian Americans may be more likely to be hired a lot of the time, but we are also the least likely to be, once hired, promoted into executive management, because the model minority, that quiet, unassuming, technical worker, is not perceived to be a great leader, right? And so there is a ceiling, right? That bamboo ceiling is actually a real thing. The other piece of it is that the model minority is just the construct of our immigration system, right? That since immigration reform in 1965, basically, you know, there's been heavy recruitment of professional class people from Asia. So, for example, those who've noticed that there are lots and lots and lots of South Asian doctors and radiologists and engineers, well, you know, during the Vietnam War period, South Asian doctors, engineers, radiologists, other kinds of medical professionals were recruited specifically to come to the United States to deal with a major medical services labor shortage that was created by the combination of the war and Medicare, right, which suddenly made medical care available to many more people in the United States. So, you know, those are the kinds of things that have basically gentrified Asian America and make us look a certain way. But if you look at our countries of origin, they're much more diverse. We are not, in those countries, more likely than Americans to have, you know, college educations, et cetera. We only come that way because of who's allowed in, right? So that's another thing just to think about it, because, you know, we do really have a Jim Crow immigration system. The other piece to think about then in all of this, though, is that that privilege is really white privilege. Right? I mean, that's what that amounts to. You know, for example, many of my friends who are Jewish say, well, you know, Jews have white privilege. But Jews have also been subjected to horrible racism, right? You know, so, you know, it's just good to keep that stuff in mind, that it is a very conditional thing, and it doesn't apply to everyone equally. There are significant numbers of Asians in the United States who are from ethnic groups that originate in places like Laos and Vietnam, for example, that have been basically, for those people, made unlivable by the war of American aggression against Southeast Asia, right? And so, you know, they come and the statistics that apply to them are completely different than for the aggregate Asian American. So I would just put that out there and just say, you know, this thing that, you know, like we have been contained in is not the thing to be focusing on. So again, on and on, but here's another like thing to think about that, right? That just kind of popped into my wee brain. The thing about, you know, race is that we should be thinking about it relationally and not comparatively, right? That's one thing that, you know, people often fall into, and I hear Asian Americans talking about that all the time. Well, compared to other people, we have it so much better, right? It's race should be thought of relationally and not comparatively, because race is a power relation. It is a relational construct. It's not one that the comparative part of it is important, because that's how white supremacy is justified, right? To compare one group against another and say this group is better than this group. When we go there, that's the game we're playing, and we shouldn't do it, right? The other thing is that we need to think of the racial categories as synthetic and not natural, right? They're political constructs. They were made in order to serve a particular purpose. The purpose mainly is greed, right? And so keep that in mind. When we focus too much on the distinctions, those comparisons between groups, we make the categories seem natural when they're not. We should not be thinking about race as a noun, right? Like a thing. We should think of it as a verb, as something that was done and is being done to us all the time, and be aware of that. So I think those things are super duper important in thinking about how Asian Americans should address the issue of race. Because, you know, we didn't invent it. We got put in that category. Asians themselves don't identify as Asian for the most part in the United States, and they don't think in terms of race. They think in terms of ethnicity, right? So all that stuff, it's a, like, you know, kind of wall of words. But in there, you know, pick the stuff out that's useful. I think we need another way forward, right? And that way forward is to think about how each group relates to the other group and how altogether that system then perpetuates itself in that way. One of the things that I try to remind people of that I've learned from the immigrant rights movement, right, and from just my own research, is that in, you know, 1965, the year we got the Voting Rights Act, black participation in the workforce was slightly higher than white participation in the workforce among men. We didn't even count women back then. But if you did, the number of the black participation in the workforce would have been astronomically higher than that of white people, right? Because black women worked at a time when many middle-class white women worked in the home. So that situation, right, was how we, you know, were in 65. Now, black unemployment is more than twice that of white people, and it's worse than that because prison is a form of disguised unemployment, people, you know, and we don't count those people among the unemployed. So that's what we have, right? Once black people won full protection under the law, they became less exploitable because citizenship is how we've always figured out how to have the most exploited pool of labor. We exclude people from citizenship, Chinese workers, Japanese workers, you know, lots of different kinds of workers, and particularly black workers, right, and enslaved black people. So that's the story. But since we won inclusion for African Americans under civil rights laws, African American unemployment has exploded, right? Basically, industry pivoted, and with 1965 immigration reform, we created new labor markets, among which is an undocumented pool of laborers who are now in a Jim Crow kind of situation. Their lack of access to citizenship, the rights of citizenship, their lack of protection is what makes them so exploitable, right? And so those two things are related, right? The kind of violence that black people face from the state and mass incarceration is the flip side of undocumented workers being exploited in the same industries that used to primarily exploit black people, agriculture, domestic work, etc. That's what I mean by thinking about things relationally. We all have common cause. Immigration reform is a Asian, black, and Native American issue, just as, you know, all of it is everybody's issue. On the Native American front with Trump, I would be remiss to fail to say that we should be very concerned about the Department of the Interior. The Department of the Interior manages hundreds of thousands of Native American trusts. The Bureau of Land Management manages the majority of undeveloped land and surface resources west of the Rockies. It would be an economic crisis for Oregon if the Bundy militia won their agenda through Trump to who owes that faction, you know, who owes his election to that faction in part. Because their agenda is privatization. Privatization of public land would be an absolute economic disaster for people across the board, and it would be terrible for tribal communities. So we need to be aware of that stuff and recognize, well, when that happens to them, what happens to us? What happens to us is not good at all, right?
I mean, I don't know why there's so much emotionality for me just personally behind Japanese internment this week, and like just because it's in the news, I don't know. But as I've thought about the model minority, maybe this is very selfish to admit, but I've thought a lot about what that took in order for that myth to become this kind of strange reality, and what we as Japanese Americans gave up. Like, what is that model minority? And it just makes me throw up in my mouth a little bit when I think about it and get a little bit disgusted. Because when I look at my own family and I think about what we did to perpetuate the model minority, we sacrificed our culture, essentially. You know, we sacrificed our language within my family. We sacrificed, you know, our names. We all have English names. We all speak English. We gave up a lot. Most people in my family have given up the religion that our family came over from Japan with. Most of the people in my family have given up our holidays. There is almost no connection to Japan anymore by most people in my family. And they don't, I don't want to say that they don't see anything wrong with it, but because this is just the lives that we're just so used to now, it's normal. It's just normal for them. And it's incredibly sad for me.
Yeah, I think it's really sad too. Yeah, I think that there's like a lot of grieving to be done for the choices that Japanese American communities have collectively made to try to assimilate and shed their heritage and the cultural artifacts that they had brought with them, but decided to shed, do away with after the internment and after World War II ended, because it's not like the prejudice and the anger went away after World War II ended, right? Thousands, tens of thousands of U.S. Marines and other military personnel died fighting the Japanese military. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure there was so much persecution. And
oh, yeah.
There's just like this huge desire to be white. And I think
I want to say it's not so much a desire to be white, but a desire to not be attacked, which ultimately was to be white. Just want to point that out. It's all about not being attacked.
Yeah. It's all part of the American narrative, though, right? I mean, it's all about using whiteness as a means of subjugating other people and dehumanizing other people, just because we're the ones that have reaped arguably the most benefits from whiteness, just speaks to how early on we experienced that persecution. And that, you know, that wasn't our choice to be among the first East Asians to come to the United States. It's just so bizarre looking back at history and seeing that, like, because we experienced a backlash first, along with Chinese people, that's allowed white America and whiteness to sort of just accept, not in a calm, peaceful, like loving way, but just to sort of accept our presence and bestow upon us a little bit more privilege, even though we don't look any different. It's not like we resemble European people mm-hmm. more than people from Africa.
Yeah.
I mean, arguably the melanin spectrum is closer, but in appearance, no. It's not even worth comparing, really. It's just that, you know, we arrived here and we didn't arrive here because we were captured from Japan mm-hmm. and taken against our will to be exploited. And it wasn't necessarily our backs that this country was built on in the form of slavery, because it was built on our backs. It was built on the Chinese backs. It was built on immigrants' backs. Mm-hmm. The entire country was. And it all came at the cost of course, indigenous people of so many different varieties. But the scars of slavery just run so much deeper. Mm-hmm. And slavery and blackness is always going to be that reference point for the privilege that we experience as Japanese Americans. And it's always going to be the reference point for the persecution that people from different parts of Asia will continue to experience because they resemble black people. You know, like people from South Asia have it a lot worse than people from Southeast Asia, arguably, because they resemble black people more.
Mm.
And I'm sure there's a lot flawed with that statement, and I would love for people to talk to me about that. But they're both going to be darker in complexion.
Yeah.
And they're both going to be treated as being the same ethnicity by ignorant white people from middle America. I think the way that we work towards racial justice is to work to recognize, like Scott was saying, that we need to recognize race as something that is applied to us as a verb, and not race as something that is a noun that is like a thing that we are, because we aren't race, right? We're ethnicity, but that doesn't mean that race isn't real. Race is like violence that's visited upon us by the structures that we live in. And I think that is so easy to forget because you're told that you are a chink. You're told that you are of less worth as a human being because you take a certain appearance.
I like that you brought up the concept of whiteness along with this idea, you know, that race is a verb and it's not a noun, because that's something that really, I think, we can do right now in this environment where everyone's kind of talking about race and wanting to have a lot of self-awareness. I think that it is extremely beneficial for white America, for non-white America, to be talking about what is whiteness. And, you know, I don't know if a lot of people really understand, like, generally in our population, that who is white has changed over the years so much, right? Like, first you were white if you were German or you were British. But, you know, when Italians first came over, they were not called white. You know, when Greek people first came over, they were not called white, right? Whiteness is this thing that is conferred upon people, right? And I've always kind of wondered this about, like, Japanese Americans as they're, like, taking this model minority thing, and it's like, wow, they're trying to adopt whiteness. They're not trying to become white people. They're trying to adopt whiteness, which is what we've seen over and over and over again in our country happen. I think it's really strange when you meet people who came over here who were not called white when they first came over, and now they're called white, and their generations of subsequent people here also call themselves white. I'm like, wow, that's amazing. And because oftentimes, you know, I noticed in kind of the general white culture in the United States, there isn't an emphasis necessarily on, like, going back to your European roots and, you know, bringing in back your cultural holidays and all these sorts of things. There's sort of a normalization in the United States that what is a normal American is someone who has kind of forgotten about their European heritage and makes jokes about being a mutt and stuff like that. Like, oh God, all the words that just make you go like, oh God, we need to talk about this some more. And, like, why not talk about what whiteness is and how that is very much a privilege that is conferred upon people and can very much be taken away.
Mm-hmm. Unless you're a white nationalist, you know, on the note of, like, you know, like, whitewashing yourself to assimilate and not get persecuted. But even then, actually, because even then, they're not trying to, like, bring back things that were authentically part of their heritage.
No.
That's not, like, they're grasping onto whiteness as their own narrative that they're proposing, that there is a breed that is called whiteness that, like, had something to do with some nonsensical narrative that they've invented. This idea that, like, there was this supremacy that reigned true in America when we first landed on shore. And there was a supremacy because they established it. But yeah, it wasn't a supremacy in, like, moral fiber or a supremacy in, like, culture. It was, you know, they were supremely douchey in, like, what they've done in the country they've created. Yeah, good job. You know, like, you guys were the best at being douches in crafting a country.
You've been listening to Pacific Underground. A special thanks to our guest this month, Scott Nakagawa, activist and writer. To learn more about Scott and his work, check out his grassroots political lab, Change Lab, at changelabinfo.com, or go to their blog, Race Files, at racefiles.com, to read his post, The Next Wave, Getting Ready for Trump's America.
Pacific Underground is Jenna Yokoyama, Kenan Schlesinger, and me, Tabitha Teo. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at PAC Underground. You can also subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes, or visit us at pacificunderground.org.
Thanks to Chops and Blue Dot Sessions for our music this month. You can find Chops on Tumblr at Chops Music and Blue Dot Sessions at sessions.blue. Thank you to our engineer, Sam Parrish, for making us sound good as always. And of course, a big thank you and welcome to KBOO's new AM News and Public Affairs Director, Derek Crooks.
Pacific Underground is a production of KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. Big thanks to them for the studio space, love, and support.
And before we sign off, we need to give a big shout out and thank you to Pamela Santos, one of the founders and creators of our show. Tam has decided to retire from Pacifica Underground to dedicate time to her upcoming solo podcast. So on behalf of everyone in our collective, thank you, Pam, for creating a space that amplifies the voices of our community. We wish you all the success on your new project. And to everyone out there in Radioland, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next month.
Coming to the radio airwaves on Monday, June 5th at 11 p.m. The Ubu Hour Radio Western, Kill Faster Pussycat.
I don't care for the way you girls get your thrills. Enough is enough. Now give it back or I'll...
Go, Tommy! Get her! Get her, Tommy!
Adapted from Russ Meyer's 1965 cult film classic, Faster Pussycat Kill Kill.
Did you see that? That was too easy.
Monday, June 5th.
They're murderers. She killed her with her bare hands.
Kill Faster Pussycat. 11 p.m. on the Ubu Hour.
After an investigation of the treatment of prisoners at the Oregon State Penitentiary, the Oregon Department of Corrections agreed to improve conditions. Yet, 1 year later, prisoners with serious mental illness continue to be held in solitary confinement. Join us on Prison Pipeline, June 5th, to hear the Disability Rights Oregon report, Behind the 11th Door, 1 year later. That's Prison Pipeline, June 5th at 6:30 p.m.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 10 a.m. coming up. It's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary, followed at 10:15 of the special edition of Locus Focus, observing the one-year anniversary of the Mosier train derailment and oil fire. This is why they're called bomb trains, people. At 11, we'll have a Radio Geekly. That was Pacific Underground we heard in the last hour. At 11... actual Radio Geekly. We'll dive into the progressive movement within geek culture. And thanks again to all the KBOO members for all of your generous support. And a reminder that all the passive listeners are invited at all times to make that hard left turn into active support for your community radio. This is possible because a lot of your friends and neighbors